Yes. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, digging deeper into the issues that make our lives. And our guest on this hour is James Rada. James, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And so what I want to do is I want to start with a picture, and that picture is like a mosaic. What are the pieces of your life that people would need to know to have an overall sense of who you are? And we start there with for a minute or two and go to some music, and then we go more into conversation.
Well, the funny thing is, in using the term mosaic, for me, I always default to quilt.
Uh-huh.
My late sister was a quilter. Mm-hmm. And I often see life as a quilt because you have all these individual patches that in and of themselves carry value and worth and meaning and beauty. And when you tie them together into the larger quilt, all the pieces come together and are connected. Mm-hmm. So if you were to say, you know, looking at the mosaic, when my sister passed 5.5 years ago, one of the things we did is in cleaning out our house is grab the quilts.
Yep.
And in my house now, I think my wife and I, we have at least probably about 2 dozen of them.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. That's neat. So your life is a quilt. Now, what are some of the pieces of that quilt? That's the metaphor. Now, let's
I was hoping to deflect. Yeah. Okay. Oh, now I still got to answer it. A little bit of everything. You know, I think, you know, as I look back at 45 years, I've lived a fairly, in many ways, ordinary life. You know, growing up white, middle class, suburban, played ball, went to college, you know, did a lot of the things that we would have as benchmarks in our society.
Right, right.
By the same token, grew up in a community that was well mixed racially, which affected my perspectives of the world.
And 45 years ago would not have been all that common.
Yeah, we were just coming out of the civil rights movement.
And has become less common since.
Indeed, it absolutely has. So I think that experience, the experience of my relationship with my father, who is a retired college professor, who was a former professional baseball player, who was a coach. So you factor in, okay, being a guy, playing ball, you know, all the things that kind of go with that. And then here I am now, a college professor. I think the big thing, an overarching umbrella term I would use, is relationships with people, with whether it's my father, my friends, my church, my God, my current wife, my ex-wife.
Yeah.
You know, I think the mosaic is I've experienced a lot. I haven't had one of those burning bush experiences of someone who's like gone to war or faced cancer.
Right.
A lot of little bits and pieces that fill in that mosaic.
Yes. And we will go through in more, at a closer view, the pieces of the quilt as we move forward. And you've come with some music, and you wanted to start with Public Enemy, Rebel Without a Pause. And do you want to say something about that before we play it, or do you want me to just cut straight to it?
Let's cut straight to it, and then we'll talk.
Okay.
Maybe talk after.
Well, here we go.
Yes, the rhythm's a rebel. Without a pause, I'm lowering my level. The hard rhyme, where you never been, I'm in. You want styling? You know it's time to get deep. The enemy telling you to hear it. They praise the music, it's time to play the lyrics. Some say no to the album, the show. Bum rush the sound I made a year ago. I guess you know.
Terminated.
disable the power of my label. Def Jam tells you who I am. The enemy's public, they really give a damn. Strong Island, where I got a riling. That's the reason they're claiming that I'm violent. Never silent, no dope, getting dumb, nope. Claiming where we get our rhythm from. Number one, we hit you and we give you some. No gun, it's still never on the run. You wanna be an S1, Griff will tell you when. And then you come again, you know what time it is. If he's the president, pulling out my ray gun. Zap the next one, I could be a shogun. Soft and smooth, I ain't with it.
Hardcore,
raw bone like a razor. I'm like a laser, I just won't phase ya. Old enough to raise ya, so this will phase ya. Get it right, boy, maybe I will praise ya. Playing a role I got soul to. Voice my opinion with volume.
Smooth,
not what I am.
Rock,
cause I'm a man. No matter what the name, we're all the same. Pieces in one big chess game. Take a shower, boy. P.E. Our crew, not singular. We wear black wranglers, we're rap stranglers. You can't angle us, I know you're listening. I caught you pissing your pants. You're scared of pissing us, the crowd is missing us. We're on a mission, y'all.
Yo, Chuck, yo, yeah, man. Yo, you got a running skin, man.
Terminator X. Terminator X.
And that's Public Enemy, Rebel Without a Pause, and our guest on this hour is James Rada. James, tell me about, or Rada as they call you up at Ithaca College. Rada, I was like, why that song?
It's the summer of 1987. I'm home from my freshman year at college, and me and two of my best friends, twin brothers, Gary and Glenn Parm, were hanging out. There was a radio station out of Philadelphia. I was born and raised right outside Trenton, New Jersey, a suburb called Ewing. Radio station out of Philly, Power 99, WUSL, used to do the Power 9 at 9, top 9 songs. And this one comes on, and the music just blows my mind. And we're sitting there, we're listening to it. We used to get together, listen to it, you know. These kids nowadays, back in the days before the internet and everything, where you would gather and, you know, you'd listen.
Sit together and listen together.
Exactly. But there's one line in there where he says, recorded and ordered supporter of Chesimard. And I kept saying, what is a Chesimard? I've never heard that. And one of my buddies said, it's a woman who, there's something very political about it. He said, there's something, and he didn't quite grasp it, but he said, in trouble with the law, okay? Very, very vague. He wasn't sure, but it was okay. So that summer, I was working at the college where my father taught, Trenton State College, and I was with helping out in the carpenter shop.
Mm-hmm.
And one day, we're repairing the roof at the campus police station, and I see the top 10 most wanted list, and I see her name there. And if I recall the story correctly, the woman was convicted of murdering a New Jersey state trooper, and fled to Cuba. And so here's a line here, which I don't agree with. I would certainly not be a supporter of such a person.
Right.
Many of my dad's former students went on to become state troopers, interestingly enough. But it was at that moment where I stopped in my tracks. I was standing there. I still remember walking through and seeing the picture of this person. And here I was, coming up on 19 years old. And it was at that moment when I stopped and I said, you are a very small fish in a very large ocean. There's a world out there that you don't understand, and you have so much to learn, son.
Mm-hmm.
And this song really, I mean, Public Enemy, first of all, their music was just incredible, but their lyrics went so much deeper. And in 89, when they come out with Fight the Power, mm-hmm. and you listen to the lyrics, and Chuck D's got a great line. He says, while the rhythm's designed to bounce, what counts is that the rhyme's designed to fill your mind. And it's like, yeah. And, you know, like I said, I lived a very common upbringing at that time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we weren't at war. We were out of the civil rights movement.
Right.
I was a happy kid having fun. Bobby McFerrin, Don't Worry, Be Happy. And in Fight the Power, Chuck D says, Don't Worry, Be Happy was the number one jam. Damn, if I say it, you can slap me right here, man. And it's like, yeah, stop. Listen, there's still stuff going on around you, you know? There's still work to be done. And
right.
I think Public Enemy just opened my mind to let me know how much I didn't know, you know?
Well, what happened to you? I mean, how did that change the way you lived?
I think I became less of a sleepwalker. Okay. You know, I don't, you know, it wasn't like I was sleepwalking oblivious through life, but I realized, you know, it wasn't just what I was reading in the books or seeing on the evening news, that there was so much and so much more depth to what was going on in the world around me at that time. And I think it caused me to stop and reflect upon myself, but upon everything else and say, okay, you know, you don't always have to take everything at face value.
And I guess one of the things, having grown up kind of after the civil rights movement or in the tail wisps of it, as well as with the Vietnam War, that's, you know, yeah, there were no causes to latch onto, and there were lots of the beginning of games and stuff like that. The kids were not necessarily video, but well, video, but not computer. Yeah. And then it became all sorts of other stuff.
Yeah.
How did you know? How has that awakening informed how you continue to work?
Well, I think you came across. You said a key word: causes. My generation doesn't have a world war to fight. Clearly conflicts, there are conflicts that are being fought. But if we look back at the last, you know, 100 years, we can see some major moments, whether it's the Depression, World War II, the Cold War, Civil Rights Movement, Women's Rights Movement, and many others that spilled from that. And our generation right now is, you know, in context, in a comfort zone. And so I consider myself a person who is driven by, okay, don't get comfortable. Make sure you're working to make the world a better place. You know, have a cause, even if it's an overarching cause of, you know, betterment.
Right.
You know.
Right. And where has that cause taken you?
Well, right now it brought me to Ithaca, New York. And the projects I work on, my last two documentaries, the one that aired last summer on PBS was the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. And the one before that was the last segregated army unit from World War II. One of the last segregated army units, the Buffalo Soldiers of the 92nd Infantry. Interestingly enough, tomorrow I will be going to interview one of their white officers who lives nearby here.
Oh,
he's 100 years old now.
Wow.
His daughter came across the website that I made for the unit and contacted me. He actually lived in Ithaca for a while. He's donated some of his memorabilia to the, I don't know if it's the Tompkins or the Ithaca Historical Society.
Right.
So it got me into documentary, I think, in a lot of ways, in discovering people's stories.
Right. This is fascinating. We also had a white commander of the 442, which was the Nisei
troop
here, who was the only one that they would invite back to their reunions because of the degree
the
of
hatred.
Respect. Well, they felt that he respected them, but the others did not. And so it was an intense many stories.
Yeah.
So documentary film around matters of civil rights, race, racial injustice.
That's where I am right now.
And what brought you there? Where did you start? I mean, you said you were in San Diego State. And that was the first white minority city.
Yeah.
In the U.S.?
Well, born and raised right outside Trenton, New Jersey, and I went out to San Diego State for undergrad, majored in journalism, played football. And San Diego State, you know, it wasn't quite known as the Harvard of the West. I mean, I didn't go there because I thought I was destined for a Rhodes Scholarship. I was playing ball. I was
having fun.
Yeah.
And you were also getting an education.
And, you know, loved journalism, loved stories. And the thing was, you know, as I said, with Public Enemy and others beginning to open my mind as I got into journalism, I said, you know, the news right now is kind of empty. What I was seeing on TV, network news, especially at the local level at that time, I was in San Diego, which was Hollywood South and Hollywood Light. A lot of the local news, we weren't doing any news. And so it was that search for, okay, there's got to be something out there. There's got to be more to it than this. There's got to be more depth. And I don't want to put myself up on a pedestal. I mean, I was hoping, I was playing ball. I played baseball my freshman year at a school right outside LA, transferred down to San Diego State to play football. I mean, yeah, I wanted to be like a pro ball player and then retire and become a broadcaster. So it wasn't like...
You fall on the tails of your father's life.
In many ways. Yeah, yeah. In many ways. So it wasn't like I wanted to, you know... write the next Bible, you know, but it was all these things started coming together, bits and pieces that started waking me up. One of my favorite journalists from that time was Charles Kuralt, you know, and it's funny when you have a guy, okay, this is late 80s. Obviously we're on the radio, people at home can't see me, but 6'5", 270 pound offensive lineman playing football, whose Sunday rituals before the VCRs are, you know, really ubiquitous, is CBS Sunday Morning with Charles Kuralt. And at that time, Sunday nights, Murder, She Wrote with Angela Lansbury. I mean, talk about breaking the mold. Oh, my gosh. But Charles Kuralt, his ability to tell a story. Mm-hmm. And I would just be captivated by it. And even if it wasn't, you know, something of profound historical significance, the falling of the Berlin Wall, he would just tell these stories of people. And the one that comes to mind are that you call them the Gandhi dancers, African-American men laying the railroads from back in the day before the machines were doing it, where they had a rhythm and a cadence to help them, pull the rails, keep everything.
Coordinate the work and nobody
exactly.
got hurt.
Exactly. And I would just be, oh my gosh, it was, you know, just so drawn in and captivated by this. I mean, back then they would call this appointment television because, you know, you weren't DVRing it. You would have to sit there and watch it. Right. And it was, you know, here I am waking up early on a Sunday morning, you know, and sitting there with my breakfast. It's, yes, it's time for Charles Kuralt, you know.
Yes.
And so I think it was that search for more meaning, you know. Mm-hmm. However deep that meaning may be. Like I said, you know, this is a time that humanity is really progressing incredibly. Communism is falling. The Berlin Wall is falling.
Tiananmen Square just happened.
Yeah, and there's still space and a place for those lighthearted stories, you know, that reflect humanity. That reflect our society. Once again, that mosaic, that patchwork, not everybody's a Pulitzer Prize winner or a Nobel Prize winner.
Right, right. And too much of intensity is not necessarily a good thing, which is what you're teaching me to appreciate, is the movement from the from the playfulness to the more serious push and back. And we forget that, especially in a place that takes itself almost too seriously like Ithaca.
Mm.
So how did you come to choose... How did you come to choose Ithaca as a place to settle?
You know, not to get too terribly preachy here, but whatever term you want to use, I'll use the word God works. I'll use the cliche, God works in mysterious ways.
Right.
And anyone is welcome to fill in the creator or whatever.
Or reality or whatever term you can say.
Yeah, a lot of pieces came together. Mm-hmm. During what would have been about 2010, 11-ish. A lot of pieces came together with where my wife and I were in D.C. My wife is actually from right up the road here, two hours up the road in Oswego. So a lot of convergence, if you will. And I don't want to attribute it to coincidence. If you want to use the word karma, that's fine too. But just a lot of things came together with
serendipity or however you want.
Exactly. With doors opening up here. And when they opened, it was like, let's do it. And it was a wonderful thing because my last documentary, the one that aired on PBS, you know, it's funny, most of the people we interviewed, and a lot of it is centered, it's about the March on Washington, so it's centered around Washington, D.C. But here I am, just having moved up from Washington, now living in Ithaca, commuting down there on a very regular basis, got lots of hotel points out of it, you know, to do this project. But the support that I got from Ithaca College, from the Park School of Communication, from my dean, Diane Gajewski, oh my gosh, we would not have been able to do this project in this manner if I wasn't here at Ithaca, you know? And it was one of those moments of stopping and reflecting and saying, wow, you know, a lot of things came together.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, what music would capture this moment, you know, where things are coming together, but you're also, you know, We're also going to move, I think, more into what are some of the issues you care about, and what are some of the things that you try to affect the world around you?
Okay. Well, the music that would capture a lot of it, I think we'd be moving to more the jazz side of things.
Sure.
So let's see. From the list we have here, oh, we could definitely do some Ornette Coleman, free jazz.
Okay, here we go. Okay. Ornette Coleman Sextet and Free Jazz from a recording of from about 30-some years ago, I think.
Would have been 40 years ago.
And you're listening to the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is James Rada. And James, how does jazz fit into the issues you care about and the work that you do?
To me, jazz, of the music that I listen to, you know, and of the list of songs I gave you, you know, absent from that list, growing up when I did, I also grew up in the age of heavy metal, mm-hmm. and loved heavy metal before a football game. Oh, nothing better. But jazz, of those that are on the list, I mean, Public Enemy expanded my mind. Mm-hmm. I think jazz captured and expanded my soul. When I heard it, one of my favorite writers is Anne Lamott, and she has a great line when she talks about God and love and spirit. She said, it's when you feel your heart jump. And one of the things about jazz that I think ties into that, I mean, when we talk about things, you know, beyond human understanding and comprehension that we don't really have words for, when I listen to jazz, and free jazz especially, by Ornette Coleman, because he basically, I mean, it's a 30-minute piece. Mm-hmm. You wonder if he even stopped to take a breath. I mean, it's this nonstop. It's just, I don't want to use the word, but it's spastic. But it's incredible. And you're listening to this going, it's indescribable. And as I'm listening to it, jazz at that time, free jazz being one of them, I started feeling it.
Mm-hmm.
And jazz was something that got me into really, you know, understanding how to feel the music a lot mm-hmm, better mm-hmm. and got me much more into, you know, my spiritual side mm-hmm. at that time. And, you know, building off of, okay, here's all these things I don't know and I don't understand,
right.
You know, and let's not be afraid of them. Mm-hmm. Let's mm-hmm. embrace mm-hmm. them. Whereas, you know, I grew up, I mean, I was in the fourth grade orchestra,
right.
You know, where everything was 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3. And here's some, and jazz itself to me is so fascinating because it's like, okay, you've got that 1, 2, 3, 4, but you've got that little pause in between when you take a breath,
right.
Do something with it. And you're like, oh
right.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
And the other thing about jazz is when, you know, you can take any jazz standard mm-hmm. and see it's been done 10, 15, 20 times, different people, mm-hmm. and each one gives it a different tone and a different meaning to it and a different feel to it. Mm-hmm. And that's what I love about jazz is there's no one right answer.
Right. Right.
You know, and there's really no wrong answer. I mean, you can be a bad musician,
right.
but there's no one answer that you say, okay, that's the way to do it. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, there's so much you can do with it. And it just, it helped me expand beyond, you know,
I'm going to racialize a comment here,
yeah.
but I think for a lot of middle-class white folk, jazz allows a kind of improvisation that in the middle part of the 20th century, we abandoned with modernity and mass production, mass consumption. Mm-hmm. But in our roots, rural white roots or kind of the a cappella singing traditions, mm-hmm. there's room for improvisation. There's a strong structure, but there's room for improvisation. And I know that jazz and blues and African-American mm-hmm. music influenced white music, but white music also had its own forms of improvisation.
Absolutely.
That ran parallel. And this has been a wonderful story of rediscovery.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, you mentioned music of Appalachia, mm-hmm. and I remember hearing Ray Charles mention one time, you know, what music influenced him, and he talked about country music, mm-hmm. the soulful nature yeah. of what was country music back then. I mean, we hear it now, it's, I think, much more rock and roll.
Right, it's pop music. Yeah.
You know, but when you hear some of the soulful, mournful... Mm-hmm. That comes out of it. And, you know, even just last week, watching CBS mm-hmm. Sunday Morning, Audra McDonald playing Billie Holiday. And to hear her capture, you know, Billie Holiday's voice and to feel mm-hmm. what the words mean. Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, I think a lot of us, as you said, you know, we've become very sterile.
Right, right. And one of the things that I'm seeing in this conversation is that you are not just a teacher, you're also a performer in your own right.
I would hope so, but please don't ask me to pick up a musical
instrument. No. But I mean, in terms of the way you regale the question, and what is it that you teach?
Hopefully, discovery. Mm-hmm. I'll teach the hands-on of this is how the camera works and this is how you edit using this software. Mm-hmm. But hopefully, discovery along many levels. I mean, I teach journalism.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so let's look at the First Amendment, and there is one. Business, one corporate entity that's mentioned in the First Amendment, religion, assembly, press, petition,
right,
speech.
Right.
So I'm teaching democracy in a way, too. Mm-hmm, I'm hopefully mm-hmm. teaching critical thinking. I'm teaching, you know, once again, with journalism, there are wrong answers when you're writing a story, but there's more than one right answer. It's
right.
not a true, false, multiple
many
choice.
Ways to put
so
it.
Hopefully, you know, teaching a little bit of discovery. Yeah.
And what? How do you frame the assignments or the work to... encourage or to invite discovery? How do you set up the awkwardness? I mean, discovery often comes from the unexpected. How do you try to build that into your teaching?
Well, I think, you know, focusing on the documentary class, my main class, one of the things is, you know, if you want to use the term being bilingual or being kind of a code switcher as a teacher, what you do is you say, okay, I want you to write down what emotion I should feel when I reach the end of, you know, the 5 minutes, when they're mm-hmm. when they're doing rough cuts, showing me their clips. What should I feel? So they're doing the concrete, okay? Mm-hmm. But here's the thing. They're not telling me until the end. And then I turn, and of course, we do this as a class. So you have... Let's say a group of four. Then you have the other 12 members of the class who are viewing it. And you say, okay, what was your desired outcome? And then you go around to the other 12. Okay, did you accomplish this? So it's what are you seeing, mm-hmm. what are you hearing, but what are you feeling mm-hmm. with this? And it does not need to be, like I said, you know, this, you know, everything needs to be groundbreaking. You know, it can be funny. Oh yeah, you should make me laugh.
Right.
You know, it can be informative. You should feel more knowledge. That's fine. But where are we at the end of 5 minutes, 7 minutes, the right. end of your documentary?
And in life, it's how we do the mundane with interest.
Exactly. I heard a great line, and I cannot quote it verbatim, many years ago from Studs Terkel.
Mm-hmm.
And it's how we get through our mundane, you know, because most of our lives, if we look at it, are mundane, not in a bad sense, but very ritualistic.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it's how we take ourselves, you know, how when we feel, because when we stop feeling, you know, that's when we have problems.
Yeah. And it's also reminiscent of the Woody Allen line, 80% of life is just showing up.
Amen.
And just getting yourself dressed and ready and out the door and,
absolutely,
and on to the next thing.
Absolutely.
Which is pretty, you know, yeah, yeah. How have you, you know, you work around issues of race and class a lot in your work.
Mm-hmm.
So how did you come to that, coming from, I would assume, a middle-class suburb or in New Jersey? How did you come to that as an honest expression of your art?
Well, I think one of the blessings of growing up, you know, and I don't want to put my hometown up on a pedestal and say, oh, it's the best place in the world to grow up. It was very average in many ways, but it was a suburb of Trenton, New Jersey, and so it was more racially mixed than a lot of places.
Mm-hmm.
And as strange as it sounds to say this, I think one of the benefits was having my father taught at what was then Trenton State College. It's now the College of New Jersey, which at the time, 70s and 80s, was a well-mixed college.
Mm-hmm.
Growing up and having white friends who were prejudiced.
Right.
Some, I would even say, racist, bigoted.
Right.
As you're a kid and you're, you know, 8-10 years old, you're not really ideologically in-depth, but hearing them say things that I would see were wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And I still use it, and you know, it's funny to hear it today. In our age, we're much more enlightened today than we were 40 some years ago. But I still remember one kid saying, "Well, you know, black people can't take showers because of the grease in their hair will fall out." Now keep in mind, my dad teaches phys ed, coaches baseball, okay, mm-hmm. at this local college, and it was not even a week later, and I remember going up there and walking by the locker room and seeing all the African American guys coming out of the shower and going, mm-hmm. okay. That kid who told me that, he's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And so seeing that dichotomy growing up, and then because I did play ball,
mm-hmm.
and our teams were well mixed, and many of my friends were not white, and you know, those that were white, when they would say, "Oh, you hang out with so and so," it's mm-hmm. like, there's nothing wrong with that. You know, when you would be able to draw who was in effect right and wrong,
right,
and
right.
see it was these kids who were, and realizing as I look back at it now, okay, they were 10, 12 years old. Clearly, this wasn't, you know, innate in them. This was what they had heard and they were being brought up with. Yeah.
Parroting, yeah.
You know, so it's not like I'm going to, you know, typecast them for the rest of their lives.
Right.
But so I think it was one of the blessings was being able to see that dichotomy on a regular basis, maybe mm-hmm. not a daily mm-hmm. basis, but on a regular basis, you know, where stereotypes would be undermined
mm-hmm.
and just kind of saying, okay, yeah, you know.
Now, and you did it at an age, particularly that age, when you, the first time you said it was about age 8.
Probably,
no, but you know, what I'm reading is that at age 7 or 8 are when people become conscious moral beings,
mm-hmm.
and that's where they get their innate sense of right and mm-hmm. wrong, and mm-hmm. they get kind of dug in on some issues
mm-hmm.
That will help shape them for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, yeah.
And that I find, you know, I find that really yeah. interesting. But also, you had you had to make sense of radically conflicting messages,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and you did it. And if we trust kids to make sense of radically conflicting messages, it means that we trust them to, we don't have to always give them the right message, because in many ways there is no right message.
Sure.
They're going to need to, what matters is that they learn how to be sensitive and aware and make judgments
sure,
the way
sure.
you did.
Yeah, yeah, agreed.
And that's something that we've almost lost as a culture, is we want to try to feed people what the right ways are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny you saying that just gets me to thinking too, you know, fast forward to 2007, I became youth director at my church
mm-hmm.
and I was there in that position for 3 years. And that was kind of one of our approaches with a lot of these kids where when the parents say, "Oh, so what are you going to teach our kids?" And I said, hopefully nothing. Hopefully they're going to learn
right.
on their own. You know, right. You're going to present to them and let them make the decisions, you know, and not not just spout Bible verses at them to throw out left and right, but say, okay, you make sense of the world around you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And when you do that in an environment where other people are watching you,
mm-hmm.
and you know they're watching you, but they're not going to intervene unless they see you get way out of way mm-hmm. out in trouble.
Yeah.
What I had to come to, many people confuse faith with belief. Mm. And that's why their parents are asking you, what are you going to teach them? Because they think that belief yeah. matters. Belief is, as we know it in modernity, is kind of irrelevant. What matters is what you love mm-hmm. and what I would call faith, which is a process of discovering a life worth living mm-hmm. and striving to live it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that only comes when you make your own assessments and your own goals. So you were in that role for three years.
Yeah.
So you've almost now defined yourself as being a coach, but not a sports coach.
Exactly. I think that'd probably be a good way to put it. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Before we come into how you've changed over the years or how you've mm-hmm. become more deeply who you are, where should we go next?
Well, I would say it's the one that we have, but you don't have. It's the one the David S. Ware Quartet.
Okay, and you have it.
I do have
and
that.
And why don't you just. Listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and that's David S. Ware Quartet and Theme of Ages. And our guest on this hour is James Rada. And so, James, one of the things that I like to do as we get to know each other in this community is to learn a bit about how have you changed and how have you become more deeply the same mm-hmm. over the years? You know, how has life shaped you?
You know, I think the cut we just played would be a good example of that. David S. Ware Quartet, and I now have to say the late David S. Ware, he passed about 2 years ago, saw him at the 2000, what was then the Bell Atlantic Jazz Festival. Mm-hmm. And it was in Philadelphia, and it was Memorial Day weekend, and they had a lot of concerts and events going on that they had tickets for,
mm-hmm.
$50, $75, $100. No, thank you. They had the one free event. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I go to that. The first two bands they had, it was free. You got what you paid for. This was like the third or fourth act, and they're coming out. You know, the lights are dimmed, and you see them sitting up. And it was interesting. It was like after the first couple, you're like, okay, you know, well, we got the tickets for free. All right, whatever. And then as they come out and they introduce themselves and the lights go up, this was their opening song, Theme of Ages. And they did the live version of it, which went about 15 minutes. I saw heaven. When I heard that music, that took me so far beyond what he was doing. That took me so far beyond my comprehension of life, mm-hmm. of afterlife, of mm-hmm. everything. And so one of the things when, you know, how have I changed yeah. and stayed the same is, I grew up in the church. You know, I read the Bible. I know the words, mm-hmm. but now I feel them. Now, you know, and I know kind of, you know, you can say, well, okay, I need to look for a particular passage in the Bible and it's something that's solid and concrete. And right. then you'd say, and there's a wonderful place for that. There's plenty of meaning in that. Mm-hmm. And there are those times when you just need to sit and be and mm-hmm. let it happen. And even God's, you know, be still and know that I am God, you know?
Right, right. But also what you're saying speaks to the idea. One of the things that I have used over the course of this show is that a test for the truthfulness of something is, mm-hmm. is it intellectually accurate? Is it emotionally honest? And is it physically compelling? If it meets all three, then mm-hmm. it's what a lot of people would call soulful or spirit-filled, mm-hmm. but it's also likely to be true, or at least as true as anything is. Mm-hmm. When mm-hmm. those things converge, when they're at odds with each other, then mm-hmm. something's happening, or if it's partial.
Yeah,
then,
yeah.
And it sounds like you're an experiential learner
yeah.
who for whom this music in its nonverbal way mm-hmm. opened something up to you.
Yeah.
What was it that got broken? What was the thing that you went beyond as you experienced this? What did you leave behind?
That's a great question, because I don't know if I did leave anything behind. I think I added
you just
on
added
to
on top of it.
I can still think back to about 2000 and taking the Briggs-Myers personality test. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And the guy who administered it, you know, and they have the four quadrants, and the one is like heavily on the administrative side. And he says, James, you scored highest on the administrative. And I said, you know, just kind of made a little joke. He says, no, you don't understand. He says, I've been doing this for 20 years. I've never had anyone score as high as you did. And so, you know, the thing is, I'm flexibly structured.
Right.
I still have the foundation. So when we talk about, you know, how I've changed and stayed the same, I've still got the foundation of my upbringing. Mm-hmm. And as I look at who I am and what I am now, there are things that I can tie back to that
right.
that are right. concrete, but there's a flexibility in it because the world has changed.
Right, you know? Right. I guess, and this leads kind of to another question. What have you had to learn to let go of that wasn't quite as you thought it was? What has forced you to change a commitment or grow suspicious, you know, since that initial kind of awakening with Public Enemy and Rebel Without a Pause? Mm. What have you learned that's forced you to step back and redo things?
Wow, that's a super deep question, and that's one I don't.
So not everybody has. I'm just.
Yeah,
I'm
I don't have
it
an.
There.
I don't have an answer at the ready. I guess the one thing is, you know, especially growing up when I did in the 80s, I mean 70s and 80s, born in mm-hmm. 1968. The thing that I think really has caused me to step back and reorient is. Trying to be me, mm-hmm. You know, we grew up in such an image conscious society back then where you were looking at what other people, how they were looking at you. And you were
looking at how your package compared to everybody
yeah,
else's,
you know,
and that's not how you
yeah,
are.
You were almost carrying around your own mirror with you,
right,
you know,
right,
and it
right.
was like, nope, this is me. This is who I am. This is what I am. You know, this is where I am. Mm-hmm. And, I guess, you know, being true to oneself, you know, and realizing that, you know, the definition of self is not something you can take in a Briggs-Myers personality test.
Right.
That
right.
I think that was the big thing is saying, yeah, I mean, you know, Louis Armstrong has a great line about what makes for good music. He says, do you tap your feet to it? Can you tap your feet to it? It's good music. So it's kind of the same thing. I mean, if you like this food, it's good food for you. It may not
right.
be mine.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so it's that sense of, you know, not putting on airs, you know?
Right, right. But what makes what you're saying different than the kind of the presumptuous individualism, you know, people being out there mm-hmm. for whatever reason that dominates a lot of our culture or our fantasies of what it means to be an individual.
Mm-hmm.
What you defined yourself with at the beginning of the show was relationships.
Yeah.
And for people who've come out of the kind of preppy 80s and mm-hmm. and had to kind of define themselves not as a role or as a product or as a type, but rather I am an individual and my tastes are quirky. My life is quirky. My body's quirky. Yeah. Especially as I age, I understand the quirkiness of it all a whole lot more. But I am deeply committed to these things and these other people.
And so
it doesn't matter what the package looks like. It just matters what that you are and that you have others with you.
Yeah. And I think picking up on one of the things you said, you know, I understand the quirkiness and I'm okay with that, which I don't understand. I mean, I hope to understand and I hope to gain enlightenment, but it's like, okay, there's still a lot out there I don't know. I still want to pursue it. But, you know, I think coming up, and you also made reference earlier to, you know, back in the 50s and 60s when we started mass producing and everything became assembly line, we like to think everything fits in a little neat box, you know, and that we watch a drama on TV and all of your problems are solved in 22 or 48 minutes or 44 minutes now for a TV show. No, it's much more than that. And I remember living right outside Washington, D.C. In the fall of 2002 when they had the D.C. sniper. And you had a lot of people saying, why can't they just do all the stuff they do on the TV show CSI? And it's like, well, the cops are doing that. But in normal time, it takes 3 to 4 months to do these things. Whereas on TV, it takes 44 minutes where you wrap everything up and the music video starts at the end, you know. And I think that's a lot of life is saying, okay, it doesn't all fit into that little box.
Right. And how do you get people like your students or your family member? How do you encourage people to hold on to the ambiguity, the uncertainty, the lack of clarity as things play out? Because you're in the industry that produces the 44 minutes.
Oh, no, I know.
Shows,
but it's
not true.
Yeah, but you know, this is one of the things is there's a lot more on TV now. And yeah, you may have to go to cable for it that does embrace the ambiguity. And I think it's, you know, it's letting students, and I think especially when I was the youth director for 3 years, letting the kids know, okay, it's cool. Be you. There is no right or wrong answer. It's what's right for you. And what's right for you today may not be right for you tomorrow or next week or the week after. And that's okay. And I think part of it is just like with me, is getting them to stop, take a step back and say, okay, it's all right not to be right. It's all right not to have the right answer. It's all right just to be.
Right.
You know?
And we're not going to run away and we're not going to judge you into oblivion.
Yeah.
If you are. I mean, we're with you.
Yeah.
And we're there too. What about we're going to go to some questions in a few minutes on what do you do to sustain yourself? How do you keep yourself going and how do you revitalize your life? But on the way there, should we go to Diane Reeves' Afro Blue?
Yes.
Okay.
That'd be wonderful.
Yes. And this is Diane Reeves' Afro Blue.
Dream of a land my soul is from. I hear a
from I Remember and Afro Blue. And our guest is James Rada. So James, one of the ways that I like to end the show is to ask people, what do you do to, you know, to restore yourself? What are the things that you do to get your mind and your body and your heart kind of back in alignment and working together and making, you know, how do you prepare for to let go of one thing and move on to the next?
You know, it's a great question, and it's one, you know, not to sound like a politician and be evasive here, but it's one that there's no one answer.
I have 85 answers on I have more than 100 answers recorded, but I have 85 answers online. And they're all a little bit different, and there are some patterns.
You know, it's interesting because sometimes it's getting away, and sometimes it's unplugging, and sometimes it's plugging in, you know? Mm-hmm. There are times I like to be out in nature, in quiet, and in God's creation. And then there are times I like to be with people.
So how do you decide what you need? How do you decide when you go one way or the other?
Part of it will depend on opportunity and resources. You know, getting out in nature in Ithaca in the wintertime is a little different, you know?
It's a cold nature. Yeah, exactly. I kind of like it because I kind of like the cold weather.
Up to a certain point, yes. up to a certain point. So it depends on a lot of circumstance. I mean, sometimes it'll be, let's just stop and be. Let's fire up the music. Let's plug in, you know, back in the day, I'd say, you know, the CD player, now the iPod. Sometimes it's a book. Sometimes it's talking to friends. Sometimes it's, you know, now that the weather's gorgeous, sometimes it's just sitting on the back porch or the front porch and just being, you know? And so and you know, sometimes for me, it's also, getting, you know, I mean, when you mentioned, you know, balancing the heart, getting the heart rate up too. For me, a good bike ride, a good swim, even, you know, time on the elliptical, brisk walk with the dogs. When I start breathing, when I start hearing my own breath and feeling my own heartbeat as it's getting faster, as the cardio is building, sometimes that helps do it too. And I don't know if that takes me back to, you know, being a ball player and, you know, being a kid again.
But also, well, at the very least, it takes you to some endorphins.
Exactly.
After 7 minutes or so.
Absolutely. No, yeah. it absolutely does. There's no doubt about it.
Do you work out on a daily basis, one of those many ways?
Try to. Try to. On a regular basis, yeah. I'm pretty regular in the gym or you know, with the dogs on the dog trail or on the bike. Yeah, so I try to, when the opportunity permits, to get my hour of good cardio per day. Yeah. As you mentioned earlier, as we get older and learn the quirks of our bodies. Yeah, and trying to keep that body functioning.
And the music is like a non-rational way to kind of get engaged, even though there may be words and you may listen to them, but it has a way of pulling your emotion and your whole body and your mind into one thing. What do you read on a regular basis?
Gosh, as eclectic as you can imagine. I mean,
whatever's around.
Whatever's, you know, sometimes it's almost whatever's next in the stack. I mean, I just finished Jonathan Katz's book, The Work of Dogs, which is not a recent one that's been out for a little while. You know, our connection to our four-legged family members, which is very strong for me. I always had dogs growing up. My wife and I met through our dogs.
Oh, wow.
So for me, the connection to, you know, the canine and now feline world, you know, is very strong. So it's kind of like grabbing what's next. But, you know, I will read some spiritual book, anything from Anne Lamott that comes my way. I just finished a few months ago Proof of Heaven, and I forget the guy's last name. I think his first name is like Eben. But fascinating book, a guy who was a neurologist. A scientist, and he says, if there's anyone who should not believe in heaven, it's me, because I know science, I know hard facts, I know what's in front of me. He is afflicted with, I want to say a meningitis, and he has this out-of-body experience, and he comes back to all his doctor friends, and he said, explain this to me medically and scientifically. They go, we can't. but we don't believe that there's a heaven. And he says, but we have no other explanation for it. So, I do the Ithaca Friends of the Library book sale. Mm-hmm. And so I don't go to just one section. You meander through and you come back with a stack.
Come up with a lot of stuff.
And then you just reach for whatever's next on the bookshelf, and say, okay, where are you going to take me?
Yeah. What you have described, about two-thirds of my guests have this, one-third have a structure. They do something daily or on a really regular basis that is intended to often do these different things, exercise, reading, meditation, whatever. But you seem to be one who does it when you feel moved, when it's the thing that calls you, that it's next to you. And that's about two-thirds of the people work on some variation of that approach. And so there are some patterns, but everybody does it differently.
I like the term structured flexibility.
Yeah.
You know, it's okay. Yeah. I'm going to set aside time to read. What I'm going to read might change.
Right. Yeah. And when the time is set aside varies from one day to the next.
Yeah.
James, it's good to get to know you.
Likewise. Thank you. It's good to be here.
And you had asked that we close out the hour with McCoy Tyner's Festival in Bahia.
Yes.
Do you want to say something about that before we play it?
First heard the McCoy Tyner Trio play this live at the Cape May Jazz Festival. Cape May, New Jersey. I believe it was called Convention Hall. It's overlooking the water. So here you've got, the ocean coming up on the shore. Right. You've got them playing this. And as I heard them play this and the version that I have on my iPod, I said, I kind of think this is going to be the welcoming music to heaven.
Wow. Wow. On that note, we will go to Bahia and heaven. Concludes the Made of Clay report for this Sunday, and you're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca.